to Fitzsimmons and Flores, KNCO's local issue talk show. This is your chance to talk about issues affecting Nevada County. To be a part of the show, call 477-5626. That's 477-KNCO. Now, here are your hosts, Tom Fitzsimmons and Holly Grimaldi Flores.
KNCO News Time, 107, 81 degrees, sunshiny day out here this Thursday in Grass Valley. And yes, a little bit of road problems out there, so just be careful driving on the Golden Center Freeway right now. Having a few issues out there. A
couple of this and that.
Yeah, and I've always been amazed, Holly, with the road construction going out there, how nicely people have handled the construction areas and not have any issues. But I guess today we're making up for it, so just be careful out there.
Just a little bit. The sun is shining, clear skies, of course, we'll have traffic.
That's when we're going to have problems.
Our guest today is Diane Covington Carter, who is a writer, a teacher of writing, and a published author. And I have known Diane now, we're trying to figure it out, we think maybe 12 years or so.
Wow.
And I met her, I think because you came to us for Optimist Club meeting, Diane, and taught us a little bit about how to write.
Well, yeah, what happened is I came as someone's guest, and then the speaker didn't show up, and I just raised my hand and said, I'll do something, and I did a little writing exercise where people had to pick a color and write, and
you
people
did.
Were all excited. Yeah,
yeah.
Well, it was really fun.
Good for you.
It was very fun.
Yeah.
And then she was happened to be teaching classes on writing, and I have always wanted to, I always have been writing, but I wanted to start writing with purpose, I guess. So I took the class.
Really? Are you a writer, Holly?
I journal. I don't really write.
Do you?
I keep thinking that one day I will write.
Okay, no, that's good.
But that's how we met.
That's right.
And that was a great experience. And then since that time, every time she offers a class, I'm going to go, and then I don't.
All right. So this is an opportunity. This is going to be an opportunity. By the time we're done here, we're going to see if we can get you in a class.
We could be writing again.
Okay.
And then in that time, right. So you've gotten married, you've published two books.
Congratulations.
Continue to teach.
Congratulations.
Yes. So let's start with the writing classes. How does one go from being a writer to being a teacher for people to write?
Well, for me, I was blocked in my writing ability. In college, I had a bad experience my freshman year at UCLA where a teacher really creamed me with all the red ink. And I just thought, okay, I'm a terrible writer. I'll never write. And it was rehabilitating that taught me, you know, I want to help other people discover writing because writing turned out to be a huge passion for me. I love writing, and I also love teaching it. So I call it finding your writing voice. And I especially love helping women because I just heard recently that only 9% of the storytellers are women. So we got a lot of catching up to do. And we have a lot to say. So it's really fun. It's very right-brained. We use fruit and flowers and all these fun things to get you out of your left brain because your left brain's valuable, but it needs to come in later. You need to get in touch with the writing that just wants to flow easily because it's easy and fun. And then you go back. Everything I've ever gotten published has gone started out this way, and then I go back later, put on my left brain editing hat, and I go, okay, yeah, we'll add this and take that out. But you want to be able to write freely, and that's what I teach, is how to write freely.
Without your own inner critic.
Exactly. You got to stop that inner critic. And also the thing we do in our class is no criticism. If you read something, when you read something you can, you don't have to, we admire what is admirable. Mm-hmm. So we never say anything negative. If you admire what is good, people will automatically figure out, oh, that works. Oh, okay. And they know what not to do. So I think that's very important, too. When people are just finding their voice, you want to be very careful to not invalidate them.
You know, that number, 9%.
9%.
So that means 91% of storytellers are men.
Yes.
So why is it only 9% that are women? I mean, is there a reason for that?
You know, it's a very good question. I think hopefully that will change very soon. And I don't know the answer, but I'm doing what I can to try and change it.
Well, I'm thinking Little Women in that era where women weren't published, and so they would use... what do you call it? A different name?
Yeah, that's
and
right. Pen name.
Pen name, so that they could get published. So it wasn't encouraged for many, many generations.
It wasn't.
So that makes sense.
And I'm a baby boomer. I was raised where you were supposed to look pretty and be quiet. You know, so there's a lot.
How'd that work for you?
Not very well. I've always had a lot to say. But, you know, I think there's a lot of late bloomer baby boomers, and I'm one of them. And I want to encourage all women of all ages, but especially some of my age women to come on out and get your voice, find your voice.
And you do have a class coming up.
I do, this Saturday. And it's taught at my beautiful little farm on Willow Valley Road in Nevada City, 9:30 to 4:30. It's very fun, and I just invite people to contact me on my website, which is dianecovington.com, or give me a call, which is, I can give my number. It's 265-4050 if they're interested.
Now, Diane, is the class for women only or men
and
women?
No, it's men and women.
All right.
Yeah.
And all day, we break for lunch.
Yeah, we do a potluck lunch, and we chat about writing during lunch. We do about four different exercises, and people leave by the end of the day with at least four pieces of writing that they love and they're amazed by. Like, wow, I really wrote that. My husband took it from me, and he went to Yale, so it was very left-brain. Mm. And he was so excited about what he wrote about a strawberry that he read it to me at dinner again after he'd read it in the class, an ode to a strawberry.
How did that work? I mean, that's pretty amazing for a Yale guy to write about a strawberry.
I know. Well, I have people pick a piece of fruit, and then I have them describe it and, you know, just use their senses and stay in your sensual mode and don't think, just let words come. And he got into a very creative, fun space that he'd never gotten into before, and he really was excited.
Is there incense and other things,
no,
like earthy music or what?
No, just the exercises, which involve sensual things like fruit.
Wow. Mm-hmm. How neat is that?
Yeah.
I remember, and I don't know what the prompt was, but I remember being taken back to a, you know, you start with a scent or whatever, but it took me back to a family story that I'd long forgotten about, you know, something that was... happened in our family, and so I wrote about that.
Do you want to share the story? Is it something you can share?
Yeah, it was. It's just actually a thing. So when I was young, my mom would make lasagna, and then I didn't like the ricotta cheese in the lasagna, so she would always make a special one just for me that didn't have that in it.
What did she put in instead? Do you know?
Just had extra cheese, you know,
extra
different cheese, but not that
mozzarella.
Kind of cheese.
Yeah.
But I had long forgotten that that was a thing, and my siblings, because I was the baby, always said I was spoiled, and that was just one example of that. Maybe I did get a little extra treatment.
We all had babies in the family,
But that memory was long gone, mm-hmm. and it was prompted by the writing class, and then became this little tale with something special between my mom and I.
Now, behind the scenes, and I'll share this with Diane, you notice Dave in the other room was saying, like, maybe he's doing this, maybe to tell a story after the break. I knew it was one of your stories. I knew we can get
that. Short and sweet.
It's short and sweet. I knew that's where it was heading. Diane Covington Carter is our guest, talking about writing and also talking about her new book that she has as well. We'll be talking about that. If you have a question or comment, 477-5626, 477-KNCO. We'll be right back. Hey, NCO News Time, 119, 81 degrees. Welcome back to Fitzsimmons and Flores for this Thursday afternoon. Diane Covington Carter, our guest, author, teacher.
And has a writing class. If you'd like to... find your writing voice, it's called. It's actually this Saturday from 9:30 to 4:30, and you can get more information, Diane at dianecovington.com, 265-4050. But the real reason we brought Diane here is because also since we met, she's not written and published one but two books. The second book is just, she has a proof copy, and the real deal is on the way.
They're
the
on their way,
copy.
Yeah. They are.
And so tell us a little bit about the book, how you got started, why you decided to write it.
Yeah, well, it ties in with the 70th anniversary of D-Day, which is coming up June 6th. And I grew up with my father talking about his time in France in World War II. He was an engineer for the Navy, so he wasn't in infantry, which is different. So he was in one place for 5 months. He didn't move around like most of the soldiers. And the Seabees were building things and repairing things. And so he was at the camp above Omaha Beach. He built the camp, maintained the camp.
Wow.
And so he got really close to an orphan boy who lived next door to the camp named Gilbert. And so during the 5 months my dad was there, my dad grew up on a farm in South Dakota. He loved to see people eat. And Gilbert looked skinny. So it all started where he said, come on, little guy, you know, come with me and I'll take you through the food line, the officer's mess tent. So he did that one day for lunch, and then that became a daily ritual. And then Gilbert, you know, who was hungry for male attention, a father, lived with a grandmother woman and her granddaughter, no men. Just started hanging around my dad. And my dad was the kind of guy who loved kids. You know, he would include you in his, he always was like that. You know, if you were around him, he would make sure that you knew he knew you were there. So as Gilbert started going down to the beach and unloading the ships and hanging out and riding in the Jeep, and just so at the end of the 5 months when my dad got his orders to come back to the States for a month and then go to the Pacific, he tried to adopt Gilbert, but he wasn't able to. The French authorities said no. And so they had to say goodbye.
Huh.
And I grew up hearing the story about the Gilbert Duclos and eat your vegetables. Gilbert didn't have enough to eat. And so, really? You know, I went on to study French and have this interest in France, not really associating that with Gilbert. But then after my father passed away, the 50th anniversary of D-Day was coming up in 94. And I thought, you know, I want to write an essay about my dad and his stories, because that would be a different point of view on D-Day. I called it Touching the Heart of D-Day. And so I went to France to actually learn about the invasion more than just my father had told me. And being there on the shore above Omaha Beach, I thought, you know, I wonder whatever happened to that Gilbert Duclos.
Hmm.
And that's planted the seed of...
Sure.
So my book is called Reunion, Finding Gilbert. And so it's the story of how I went to find this man and what happened.
And...
Well, that's a powerful premise, by the way. I mean, that's one of the most powerful days in U.S. history, D-Day and that whole event.
It was unbelievable. I mean, I was not interested in history growing up because as a girl, I thought, just a bunch of men in wars and there's no women anywhere.
Yeah.
And it's just a bunch of memorizing dates. But when I went and I learned what my father had been a part of, I could not believe it. Yeah. You know, it's like 5,000 ships, 11,000 planes, 200,000 soldiers landing on the beach in one day. And my dad was in charge of building these Rhino ferries, which are these big pontoon barges where they could hook up to the big LSTs, unload like 600 vehicles and barge them into the shore, you know, which turned out to be they called the secret weapon of D-Day. So now I know all about D-Day.
Yeah. No, and see, my dad was in the second wave on D-Day as an Army medic.
Yeah.
You know, and so he dealt with a lot of stuff.
Oh,
yeah, he dealt with a lot of death and injuries and all that stuff.
Yeah, especially on Omaha Beach, which unfortunately was the American beach, and they lost about 2,000 young men in one morning there. My dad landed the next day, so I was very lucky.
So as an American woman coming back, what was your reception like from the French people that you were back there to kind of see Omaha Beach and also do some research?
Yeah, well, I actually was at the 60th also with Stephen Ambrose Historical Tours as a guide and a translator, and I'm going to the 70th with them also.
Wow.
And my job was to translate between the veterans and the French. The French love the Americans. When we got there for the 50th, mm-hmm. I was with my daughter. She's in the book. It was Bienvenue les Américains, you know, welcome our liberators. And they were the same at the 60th. Our bus would go by, it was Army Rangers on the side, and people would wave, and there were French and American flags hanging out of every window, and they just wanted to thank the veterans. They call them the vieux soldats, the old soldiers. They would stop on the street and, you know, touch them and cry and you know, thank them. It was beautiful. So they're still passing down. They say, we will never forget in Normandy. They're passing down the story to the children, you know, because the people who were in World War II obviously are passing away now.
Right. So your experience when you started this, writing this book, and where it took you, what was your own personal transformation like?
Yeah, this book has taken me about 5 years to really finish. I had a short version of it in Reader's Digest in 2009 that was very well received. I had people tracking me down, finding me, you know, calling information in Nevada City and getting a D. Covington and calling and saying, if this is the lady that wrote the Reader's Digest story, I just have to tell you I've been crying, you know. It's a very touching story. And so that motivated me. Okay, I got to write the book. Please write the book. Please do it. Make it a movie. And so it's hard to write a memoir. A memoir is a piece of your life. It's threads of your life, but you have to figure out what to leave out and what to put in.
Yeah.
And that has what's taken me 5 years, because it covered my whole life. This book spans 70 years before I was born, when my father was in, you know, Normandy, until now for the 70th anniversary. So what do you put in? You know, what, 70 years. I originally wrote it three times as long as it is now, and then I had to go back and cut it down to a third. And it was a very deep, powerful process. But I am a believer, you know, because I love writing, that writing is also very healing. And there were parts of my childhood that weren't good. My dad was great, but there were other parts that were difficult. And so in the process of writing this, it's been very healing.
And I think that's true of writing. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people, you start on one topic, and that's why I asked you, and you end up somewhere else completely, or you discover things you didn't realize were in you.
Yeah, it's very powerful and healing, and I recommend writing to anybody, even if they've never written, just to get The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. You could get that used now because it's been out for 20 years. And just start keeping a journal and do some of those exercises in that book, and you'll learn a lot about yourself, and you'll uncover some forgotten dreams and things like that.
Now, this little Gilbert guy,
yes.
Did your dad know?
Yes.
Did you have any resentment about him? I mean, considering you had to eat your vegetables because Gilbert...
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
I remember I was the youngest of four, two boys and two girls.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, well, if he was here, that would throw the numbers off to 3-2, right?
Yeah, boys have an advantage.
Yeah, and he was older than my brothers. And I remember thinking, you know, my brothers were teasing, and they burped loud, and they would punch each other. And I didn't really want another boy around, you know? But that was my little girl point of view. Once I grew up, and see, before my father passed away 2 years, he passed away in 91, he was still talking about Gilbert. And as an adult, I thought, you know, that person meant a lot to
yes.
him, and that planted the seed of maybe I could find him. And if we go on later, I can tell a little bit more about what happened when I found him.
We do. That's what was going to be the next question is, did you set out to find him when you were writing the story? Did you know that that was going to be part of the mission?
Or did you even know he was alive?
I didn't know anything. What happened was that essay that I wrote, Touching the Heart of D-Day, on a hunch, and I believe in following hunches, I sent it to the press attaché in San Francisco at the consulate. I thought, well, press attaché, she should know I'm writing about Normandy and my dad. And she's the one who said she knew I was going back in 94 for the 50th, because I wrote that to come out on the 50th, and I'd been there in 93. She said, you must try to find Gilbert. She made me promise, and she told me where to place the ad in the newspaper in Normandy called West France. She said, he will still be in Normandy. She said, the French don't move around like les Americans, you know, like Americans. He will still be there. Which was an interesting thought for me because we move around all over the place.
Yeah.
I grew up in Southern California. I'm up here. If somebody was looking for me in Southern California, they would not find me.
And considering the whole thing of war and just what that
exactly.
region went through.
And he was an orphan. Who knew?
Yeah.
So I guess we're going to take a break soon. I can tell after the break what happened, how I found
We've got a couple of minutes
okay.
just before we can. So yeah, just lead us to that and then...
Okay, so what happened was I was taking my 19-year-old daughter with me on this trip that we had planned since she was 14. So I had spent a lot of time planning this itinerary with her for a month, and it was a very big deal. And I also was placing the ad to find Gilbert. But because I thought it would take years, months or years to even find him, if I ever found him, I put my home address in Nevada City. And this was before cell phones and everything, so there was no real way to reach me in France. So my daughter and I placed the ad, and we took off on our tour. The next morning, Gilbert Duclos reads his newspaper and sees the ad and starts to weep. And so he calls the newspaper, and they say, well, she's just left on this tour with her daughter. But here, you know, the address was in the newspaper. You know, write to the address. And so it's a very – there's a lot to more I can tell after the break about how that message got back to me in France.
It's amazing how the difference with technology. How did we survive before?
I know.
And things
you
want to
know
longer.
Something? I find it more romantic to have it being done without the cell phone.
Yes,
myself. It's just the work and all that stuff.
Speaking of technology,
yes.
You're number one on Google for finding Gilbert.
That was probably from Reader's Digest.
Yeah,
because it was voted number one must read for months on end because it's a story about love. It's a story about love and kindness. And that's one of the reasons I believe women need to be more storytellers. That's what I want to write about. You know, I think we need to represent love and kindness much more than we do in life and movies and
yeah.
stories.
The world needs it.
Yep.
World needs it.
And it's real.
Yeah.
It really is real.
Mm-hmm.
This
Touching
is a real story. It's
yeah.
a true story.
All right. Well, Diane Covington Carter's our guest, talking about her new memoir, Reunion, Finding Gilbert. We're also talking about her class. We'll touch on that again as far as her upcoming writing class as we go through the next half hour. We've got a news break here at Jeff Lynn. Weather forecast. We'll be right back. KNCO News Time, 134 and 81 degrees. Welcome back, Fitzsimmons and Flores. Having a great conversation with Diane Covington Carter. She's our guest today, local author, local teacher, baby boomer, extraordinaire.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And a writer. And she's a woman that writes. And that's what part of we're talking about today, too, besides her new book. And there's going to be an opportunity we're going to talk about, too, about maybe getting your own signed copy of this book. But as we're going towards break,
Finding Gilbert is the basis, the reunion of finding somebody very important in your dad's life. For people that are just joining us, your dad, part of D-Day, and being at Omaha Beach, befriended Gilbert, a youngster at the time. And then as we were going towards break, Gilbert found an ad that you placed over there in France, and what happened after that?
Yeah, so I'm off on this tour with my 19-year-old daughter, and we were, because I'm a writer, I was doing a bunch of articles, and I had places arranged for us to visit, and, you know, they were treating us to spa treatments, and so we're off doing this thing, mother-daughter thing. Meanwhile, Gilbert reads the article, writes back to the address in Nevada City, which was a P.O. box. My sister, who was a very busy mother of three, had agreed to get my mail when she could. So she gets the letter, and she looks at the return address and goes, Gilbert Duclos, and knows who it is. And then, luckily, I'd given my sister an itinerary with even fax numbers of where I had meetings. I don't know why, because neither my sister nor I had a fax. So she looks on the date, and it's like the last meeting on the last possible day. And she goes to a friend's house and faxes it over to France. And it arrives in the morning of I'm having this last meeting with this last person. And someone comes around when I'm saying goodbye to this woman after lunch and says, Madam Covington, you have a fax. And I'm like, what? Who even knows where I am, you know?
Getting a telegram.
And I look at this three-page letter with Gilbert Duclos at the return address, and I start to cry. And this woman who's I've had lunch with says, you know, what is it? And I said, well, this is an orphan my father tried to adopt, and this is the first communication in 50 years. And she says, come right this moment and sit at my desk and call him right now. So I called him. And we both were crying, and he said, my daughter and I had one night free before we had to go back to Paris and spend the night to fly out early. He said, will you come back to Normandy and spend the night with us? And I looked at Heather, and she was shaking her head. So we drove back to Normandy, met him in a cafe, and there's a scene in the book where I'm waiting for him to show up, and I'm so nervous that the French are all smoking their cigarettes, and I've never smoked, and I wish I'd smoked right then, because I have something to do with my hands, because I'm thinking, this is surreal, you know, this is my father's story from when I was a little girl, and somehow I'm in the story now, and there's this man, Gilbert's going to show up, and how will I know who he is? And I was just a nervous wreck. He walks up, and he looks at me, and, you know, he says, Dion, which is how they say my name in French, and I say Gilbert, and he said, you look like your dad. And I thought, how could he even remember after 50 years when he was 7 what my dad looked like, you know? But we had this wonderful, sweet reunion, and he told me some parts of the story that my dad had left out, which I'll leave for people to read in the book, which were very, very touching. But one of the real moving thing for me was to tell him that my dad had never forgotten him.
Right, right.
And he was so touched by that because he'd never been adopted, and my dad had been the only dad he'd ever known. So that was like one of the most meaningful things of my life, to be able to tell him that dad had never forgotten him.
And, you know, and we talked about the fact that your father wanting to adopt this boy who he had developed a relationship 5-6 months of time, and then not being allowed to, not being able to, and then life just goes on.
Yeah, I know. He comes home from the war, and a lot, I don't know what happened exactly. You know, I know that a lot of the returning soldiers was like, forget about it, don't think about it. I don't know whether my mother didn't approve of the idea, which is very possible. But it just never came up to go back and try and find him until I did.
That's so interesting. I just saw Miss Saigon. I was telling Diane last week that Katz is putting on, and it's similar, different war. But people who established lives and relationships there and then came home and never kept those promises or were able to keep those promises, other people that they had relationships with that didn't allow that.
Yeah.
So those people that are left behind are always left wondering.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So Gilbert, not bitter.
He was not bitter. He was totally remembered the love and the good times, and he cherished all that. And he said to me, I always knew someone would come. Thank you for coming.
How sweet is that?
He had told his wife, his daughter, and his grandsons about this family in America that were someday going to come and find him. And I was so grateful that I had done it, because I would have hated for him to not have fulfilled that.
How did he look, physically look?
He looked good. He looked good. And
did he look like you imagined?
He was smaller, you know, because we're tall. You know, my dad was Scandinavian, I'm Scandinavian. So jokingly, we had a relationship for 14 years. And, of course, he didn't speak a word of English. So luckily, I'd always had this passion for French, right? And I suddenly understood that's why I couldn't have spoken to him. I probably wouldn't have gone to write the article. He jokingly called me Notre Petite Américaine, which means our little American, because I was like this much taller than him, you know. But yeah, we had this sweet relationship for 14 years before he passed away.
Oh, so nice.
Yeah. And I still am very close to his wife. I'm going to see her when I go to the 70th anniversary of D-Day with Stephen Ambrose Historical Tours, which I'm going to at the end of the month.
So taking something from an idea, a story, then a short story in Reader's Digest to a published novel, what is that process like? Because it seems like the world of publishing has changed quite a bit. You've gone through all the work of writing this beautiful story, and now you want to share it with people.
Yeah.
How do you now, what happens now?
Yeah, well, this is actually a memoir, which is nonfiction, just so people won't know. A novel would be that I made this story
right,
up.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Well, I am a published author. I've been written up, obviously, Reader's Digest in a lot of magazines. But I chose to self-publish this because I wanted to get it out before the 70th anniversary of D-Day.
Sure. Okay.
And if you work with an agent and a publisher, it takes a year at least to get a book out. So that's what I went ahead and did. I'd worked with agents before, and I just thought I wanted to write the story I wanted to write, so I just went ahead and wrote it. When you work with an agent and a publisher, a lot of times they're telling you exactly how to write it, and I thought this is a very personal story. And so your question again was?
Well, so now it's written. You've birthed it.
I did,
so
yeah.
So now how do people find out about it? What's next for you?
Yeah.
As you said, the work has been 5 years, but now the work begins.
Yeah, the work begins to let people know about it, because obviously if you write a book and nobody knows about it, nothing's going to happen. It's available on Amazon in paperback and Kindle. I am having a book launching on Thursday, May 15th, right here in Nevada City. It's at the Harmony Ridge Lodge, and people are invited who'd like to come and buy a book, and I'll sign it, and we're going to have little refreshments and a real celebration.
Yeah.
It's a celebration of this book being complete.
And the Harmony Ridge Lodge, for people who don't know, or maybe they've gone past it, just past the Five Mile House,
yes,
on Highway 20.
Right past the Five Mile House, there's a sign that says Tahoe National Forest, and you turn in there. And if they could RSVP to me, which I'll give my phone number again, 265-4050, because I want to have enough food and drink for everybody.
And that's 5 to 8 next Thursday.
It's the 15th. Yeah,
15th.
2 weeks.
Yeah, let's
from
not hurry
tonight.
That up.
Yeah, 2 weeks from tonight. And I'm hoping that something will be in the Union. I sent them a press release, so hopefully they'll put that in the paper as a reminder to people.
And this, we'll talk more about your book, but this is not your first book.
No.
Diane has a great story of love that she wrote about your relationship with your husband. I just wanted to touch on that a little bit.
Yeah, that one's called Falling in Love Backwards, An Unlikely Tale of Happily Ever After, because my husband and I had met 30 years before we remet. We'd met when I was 30 and he was 36, and then we met again when I was 60 and he was 66. He didn't remember me, but I remembered him, because he was leading a course that I was in, one of 100 people. And in those days, it was very unusual, because we were doing a ropes course. And back in 1979, he was one of the first courses like that. And I thought he was totally dynamic and incredible.
Yeah.
And I thought of him out of the blue 30 years later and thought, I wonder what ever happened to that guy. And so I looked him up, found him on the Internet, ordered a book he'd written. And then I, being a writer, had some ideas about his book. And I said, well, I'd like to suggest some things about your book. And he came up to talk to me about the book. I thought he was incredible still. He wasn't interested in me. So that's why it's Falling in Love Backwards, An Unlikely Tale of Happily Ever After. Like, how did we get from he's not interested in me to, oh, my God, we're happily married now. We really are. So that's what that book is about. And that was also available on Amazon.
And you wrote that with him?
Well, what happened was I had my side of the story. And when I was cutting my reunion book down, which I told you was originally three times as long, I said, you know, I got to cut off this whole end part about you. And if you write your side, we'll have a book. So it's my voice and his voice going back and forth. And he's got a lot of male issues, which a lot of the men who read it can relate to. I didn't quite fit his pictures, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he got over that. But.
And how long have you been married now?
We've been married about 2 years. Yeah, we've been together almost five.
That's really nice. Really nice story. When I met you, you were alone.
I was.
And I think looking for something out there.
I was.
The universe just wasn't quite ready.
Ready yet, no, but it came through.
She's got her mojo working. As she's sitting here, her green bottle has a peace sticker on it.
Yeah, my daughter.
All right, knock it off over there. KNCO News Time, 147, 81 degrees. It's starting to get rowdy here in Fitzsimmons and Flores towards the end of that break. Diane Covington Carter. She was talking love stories. She's been talking all this, that. And then we got into this man-woman thing.
Yes.
Just towards the end of that break. It almost got kind of rowdy in here for a second.
Well, the book that Diane has recently just finished and published, Reunion, La Reunion, Finding Gilbert. Mm-hmm. Or in Us for Americans, Finding Gilbert. Or the way I just did it a little while. I did a little while ago with Gilbert, so I had like a nice mix of the two.
That's good.
And it's having a book signing on the 15th. But the story really coming from a good memory of your father and wanting to leave a legacy for him.
Yeah.
Which is so wonderful. And then turning into something that really helped so many people and really helped this man who had, you know, some people would say abandoned. I mean, he was orphaned, but the idea that he might be rescued and never was. And so what a great story to tell, and with the anniversary of D-Day coming up. But it really has changed your life in a lot of ways, your interests, your focus.
Yeah, one of the things it taught me is that we need to trust what it is. You know, Joseph Campbell said, follow your bliss. I had this passion for French growing up in Southern California, where everyone said, oh, it's so much more practical to learn Spanish. You know, you're only an hour from Tijuana.
Right.
But I wanted to learn French, and I kept it up through the years, you know, with books and tapes and classes. Again, you know, when I had little kids, and it wasn't practical to do that, but it was something inside me that wanted that, and it was really fed me in a way. And so when I found him, and I could speak to him, it all came clear. Like, okay, I was supposed to learn French. I was supposed to do this. You know, there's that mysteriousness of life that we forget to think about. But there was, you know, what his daughter said to me, Kathy, when she said, why didn't your father come back? And there was this moment where I didn't know what to say in English or French. You know, I was just, it was silent. And then she went, le destin, you know, destiny. It was destiny that Gilbert was to stay in France so he could get married and she could be born and her sons could be born. And so there's that whole thing of destiny that I think is fascinating, because we can't understand it. It's mysterious, but it's real, you know, and I've learned that from writing this book and following this, having the story be a part of my life.
Well, and you also talk into D-Day and tying it into D-Day. And for people who haven't been back or might want to go back, or anytime people are going anywhere near France to go to Normandy to see the impact, something I didn't know that you said, that that's really part of American soil there.
Yes, the Omaha Beach, for those of people who know much about D-Day, was not a good scenario on D-Day. It was, unfortunately, there was a cloud cover, and so the air force missed the target. So when the young men came out of their landing craft, the Germans mowed them down.
Right.
And so it was really bad on Omaha Beach. So up above Omaha Beach is now the American Cemetery. And there's almost 10,000 young soldiers buried there. And so they dedicated it, France dedicated it as a piece of American soil. And they keep it up beautifully. There's volunteers from the local area who come and put flowers on the graves. And, if you go to Normandy, it's the big ceremony is this June 6th with heads of state, and that's going to be, you know, very crowded. But don't even think about that. That's not a good time to go. I would go anytime. I like to travel off season. I recommend people go in the fall or the spring or even the winter. And when you go, you can find these little, what I found was a little van that took us for the day. I was with seven other American tourists that I'd never met. And we went around, and the person who was a local took us to all the little museums and took us to all the different beaches and taught us everything about D-Day in one day. And they're not very expensive. So you can get these little tours. There's a beautiful peace museum in Caen. Caen is C-A-E-N. That's the town that's right there, the large town. The town of Bayeux, the little village of Bayeux is beautiful. There's a tapestry there of William the Conqueror. So there's a lot you can see. Mont-Saint-Michel is a beautiful monastery. So Normandy is a very beautiful part of France. And, of course, the cheese and everything, you know, it's known for that. Also known for Calvados, which is my dad called firewater. It's like the hard apple cider.
Oh. So,
yeah, it's kind of like this area. It's got a lot of apple trees and big fat cows. And it's a beautiful part of France. So
lovely. But it's interesting, so that direction of your life changed based on the story.
It totally did. You know, I had always wanted to have this connection with France that now I did. I had a family there. I had a brother there. I mean, to have family there is a big deal, you know, to go visit and be included in Christmas dinner. And, you know, and again, when I went to Gilbert's funeral in 2008 to sit with the family in the front pew, you know, as one of the family members. And his wife asked me to place a photo on the coffin that it was a frame that included a photo of my father from 1944 and a photo of Gilbert. And, you know, to actually be a part of that beautiful, deep moment that only, you know, that was a family moment. So.
And you're talking about, in writing this memoir, I'm wondering, you talked about having to really cut it into one third of the story that you had originally written. How do you find a way to piece it all together? How to make it end?
Yeah, that's the tricky part. I actually drew. I don't have it with me. I could have brought it. I drew a visual for myself of all the different threads that were important, and I made them different colors. So there was the thread of my passion about French and France. There was the thread of my father, who was so important in my life and Gilbert's life. You know, and I just had to see how I'll carry these threads forward into a story that wove together. They wove together to create the story. And then just let go of other things that weren't important for that story. So I have two other books that I'm going to write in the next couple of years of things that I had to leave out. So,
is there ever a dream when you're writing something like that, that someday it might become a movie or anything?
Yeah,
like that?
I really hope this does become a movie. I've had quite a few people who read Reader's Digest say, I see it as a movie, yeah. I want it as a movie. Yeah, it would be a great movie. So we'll see what I can do. I'd like to get into Tom Hanks's hand because he loves World War II.
Or right? Gary Sinise or somebody like that.
Yeah, because he was involved with Saving Private Ryan.
Right, that's what I was thinking, Saving Private Ryan. Yeah. Well, and I'm thinking that there is an old World War II movie with a little boy and a dog and John Wayne, and I just can't think of what it is.
Well, let's see, The Longest Day was an old World War II movie. Yeah. Was that John Wayne?
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Might have been that. That might be it.
Yeah, he was in there with everybody else, I think. There was a big actor, Henry Fonda, a whole bunch of people.
Yeah.
And Dave's nodding.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it fits. And, you know, there have been other stories, other wars, where there seems to be a young boy who is taken in by the troops. And so to know that this really does
it really
happen,
did
it really
happen.
Did happen.
Yeah.
Really has some authenticity to it.
And also it's fun to let people know about the Seabees, which is what my dad was in, because he loved that. Can do. You know, and we build, we fight, and they have this feisty bee that's carrying a drill and a gun.
That's right.
And they were the
fighting Seabees.
Yeah, they went in there and they fixed things and built things.
You know, that's another John Wayne movie.
I know, I know that. And so, you know, I'm very proud of that. And he was like that his whole life. And the Seabees are very proud of what they do. So I'm glad to kind of shine a light on the Seabees too.
Yes, David. The movie Longest Day you were talking about with John Wayne, that wasn't a little boy, that was Red Buttons. Same height.
Thanks for that, Dave.
Very cute. Actually, Rita Stevens, can I throw this in there real quick? Because Rita Stevens normally sits in the newsroom. Her dad was a CB as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
In World War II?
In World War II.
Oh, I should talk to
her. I think in the Pacific Theater, though.
Yeah, well, my dad went to the Pacific after Normandy.
Maybe. Never know that.
Yeah, we should find out if he was in the 111th, then they were in the same way.
We'll find a connection. So we have a few minutes left. I want to recap a couple of things. The book signing, which is Thursday, May 15th, from 5 to 8.
Yeah.
Harmony Ridge Lodge off of Highway 20, just past the 5 Mile House. And then you also have your writing class, which is happening this Saturday. And that is at your place on Willow Valley.
Yes.
And that's from 9:30 to 4:30. If people want to get in touch with you, 265-4050.
Yep.
And so now this is finished. What now what?
Well,
can you take a breath?
Yeah, I'm going to take a breath. You know, my job now is to let people know about the book. You know, I have to be my own publicist, which means, you know, sending out press releases and getting on the radio and... So I'm hoping to be on Insight, which is the NPR station interview. My husband and I were on for our other book.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just working on getting the word out about the book.
I think it's fascinating that you're able to, you know, I said this probably a ton of years ago, how you make a living in Nevada County as a writer. And you do a lot, you dabble in a lot of different things.
I do. I've done editing also. I'm a good editor. I'm really fast. So, you know, I've had people from my class actually write books, and then I've helped them. So that, you know, you juggle things. You wear a lot of hats in Nevada County, but it's possible. It's very possible. And I love every aspect of writing, so I enjoy editing also.
And I also wanted to ask you about Sierra Writers. Are you involved with them?
I have done some speaking for them. Yeah, but I'm not, just because I'm kind of busy, you know. And also, when I married my husband, he was living in New Zealand, and we go to New Zealand in the winter, so we travel quite a bit. And
When you first got married, it seems like I was catching up with you, seeing photos of you pretty much everywhere on the planet.
Yeah, I know. He's the world champion rower in his age group, and so we were going all over the place for rowing regattas, and yeah, it's good life. But I mean, I can write wherever I am, so that's really handy.
How about a book on rowing?
Yeah, I told him he should write a book like The Zen of Rowing, you know, because it's very zen. And he goes up to Scott's Flat Lake, which is just 10 minutes from our house. Mm. And it's so beautiful. I'm learning. And it's so peaceful up there. You're just moving through the water. And, you know, there's quiet and there's ospreys. And we live in such a beautiful place.
No doubt.
It's very nice. Anything else you want to add? We've got another minute or so.
I just want to encourage people to write, you know, that it's a way to discover things and heal things, and it doesn't cost anything. It's a pen and paper. You know, buy yourself a notebook at Ben Franklin and read The Artist's Way, or come to my class. I really am a believer in the power of writing.
Well, and you know what? What I like is that we are all these, you know, greatest generation's kids, and as they pass away, maybe writing about their stories and stuff just like you did.
That
could
That's
be
right.
a great way to keep that alive.
That's right.
You know, for our kids and all that
That's
stuff.
Right.
Yes, our generation will have no idea without stories like this.
That's right.
And, of course, for people who, just quickly, if they want to get the Reader's Digest version,
yes.
Can they do that?
Yes, you can just Google Finding Gilbert, and it will come up, Reader's Digest, and you can click on it.
All right, or spell Finding Gilbert if you're from upstate New York.
All right, Finding Gilbert.
And then Diane's number 265-4050.
That's it.
Right. How to get involved with the class, and again, 2 weeks from today, the book signing up there, past Five Mile House at the Harmony Ridge Lodge. It would be a great event late in the afternoon, about 5 to 8.
Happy hour time.
There you go.
Perfect timing. Little nibbles, a little nachos.
Little nibbles, a little bubbly.
A little bubbly.
Lots of celebrating, some French music.
All right. Thank you, Diane, for coming in. That'll do for Fitzsimmons and Flores. Stay tuned. We got ABC News coming up next.